Dexter began on March 11 of 2011. Highly radioactive microparticles dispersed from the reactor explosions and meltdowns and traveled all over not only the Fukushima Tohoku area, but have been found as far away as Tokyo and beyond. Now, with Japan all a-twitter about the upcoming 2020 Olympics and the official line being how safe it is to come on down to Fukushima, watch the games, and spend your tourist dollars, it might sound tempting to go. That is, until you hear a genuine expert tells you exactly what you might be breathing in.
These particles formed in the reactor as the fuel vaporized. As it fell down into containment, it began to mix with the melting concrete that was now mixing with all of this melted fuel. And it started making these little microparticles that are made up of nuclear fuel, the steel from the reactor, the zirconium coating, and bits of the concrete. And at some point, these were ejected out of the reactors and into the environment.
Well, when you hear that that's what might be blowing in the wind and finding its way inside your body, whether you're in Japan or anywhere in the world, you'll know that you are in the seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, the first of two special Fukushima anniversary programs, a full-length interview with Nancy Faust of Simply Info. She shares with us the highlights and hotspots of Simply Info's 2019 Fukushima anniversary update, and we're getting this information before it is published. There will be technical information, human manipulation, and some hardball nuggets of red-hot info. Nancy provides a detailed picture of what's happening at the disaster site and to the people in the surrounding area. Today is Tuesday, February 26, 2019, and here is the week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here is this week's very special interview. Nancy Faust is communications manager and research team member at simplyinfo.org, a not-for-profit research collective that holds and manages the world's largest public archive of data on the Fukushima disaster. Every year, they publish an extensively researched and vetted update on what's happening at the disaster site and to the people still living with the aftermath. This is a gold standard report, and we're fortunate to not only have secured Nancy for an interview on it, but we're doing so before the report is released to the public. So here's the breaking story, Simply Info's Fukushima Year 8 update. We spoke with Nancy Faust on Monday, February 25th, 2019.
Nancy Faust, always great to have you here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Great to be here.
This is the time of year when Simply Info puts together its annual report on Fukushima. And we are fortunate to be talking with you before pub date on this, which is very exciting. So let's get an overview. What is the situation at Fukushima now? First of all, there's a lot in this report about microparticles. When you say microparticles, what are you talking about and where do they come from?
What a microparticle is a very, very tiny piece of radioactive debris. These are small enough to be inhaled. They're highly radioactive. They also have a long half-life. And if people aren't familiar with what a half-life is, that is when a radioactive isotope decays away the time it takes for something to decay half as much as it was is a half-life. Many of these isotopes that are found in these microparticles have half-lives of tens of thousands of years. So they're dangerous in a number of ways. They're highly radioactive. On one hand, they also last a long time. Something else that makes these particularly problematic is they're insoluble. And what that means is they don't dissolve. If you put them in a liquid or, you know, some other substance, they don't easily dissolve. So if they get in your lungs, they don't dissolve in your bloodstream, you know, in a way that you can make them, you know, expel from your body. So if they end up in your lungs, these substances are very dangerous. They stay right where they're at, and they can cause some pretty serious health problems. So, you know, as we learned about these, we realized how dangerous they were. They started becoming kind of a priority in our research.
Where have they been found, and what is the importance to our understanding of the accident?
Microparticles have been found everywhere from on-site at Fukushima. They've been found in the reactor buildings. They've been found off-site nearby. They've been found in the evacuation zone. They've been found well outside of the evacuation zone in Fukushima, and they have been found as far south as Tokyo. So this is not a problem that's isolated to the disaster site itself or the evacuation zone. These have been found in some pretty far-flung places, and they were originally found by average people with a radiation detector trying to kind of understand where radiation levels were high in various places, even down in Tokyo and up outside of the evacuation zone in Fukushima. And these different people started finding these phenomena of these highly radioactive, what looked like black dust or black sand. And this resulted in these citizen groups doing their own research, and then academic researchers caught wind of it and started actually looking into this seriously. And this is how we started to really understand what these were.
What do microparticles show us about the severity of the meltdown?
What we can tell from the microparticles, we know they're this. They are little inhalable particles of nuclear fuel. And this is something people really need to remember. These are not just little problematic things. These are pieces of nuclear fuel from inside the reactors at Fukushima that are now spread through the environment, and they're small enough people can inhale them. It all starts to kind of paint this big picture of, you know, where did these things come from and what are they doing now? How they were made is very interesting, too. As fuel melts down, it can vaporize if it gets to a hot enough temperature. And the fact that these microparticles formed tell us that the meltdowns at Fukushima were extremely hot, even for the temperature ranges that would be expected in a meltdown. So we know that the fuel, as it melted down, got extremely hot. It vaporized the fuel, so the uranium in the fuel rods and the zirconium coating that's on the outside of them and the steel that's parts of the reactor core, these all vaporized as they were melting. And as they fell to the bottom of the reactor vessel, they formed these molten materials that eventually fell down into the containment. And the containment floor is made out of concrete. And this is really important because this is a very telltale sign about how all of this took place. We know that these particles formed in the reactor as the fuel vaporized. As it fell down into containment, it began to mix with the melting concrete that was now mixing with all of this melted fuel. And it started making these little microparticles that are made up of nuclear fuel, the steel from the reactor, the zirconium coating, and bits of the concrete. And at some point, these were ejected out of the reactors and into the environment. So we now know a lot about how the meltdowns happened. We also know that, at least in some of these cases, the fuel had reached the containment before it was ejected to the environment. So we know that the meltdown itself went really far before all of this stuff was released, which kind of lends us to think that the meltdowns were very far progressed before the hydrogen explosions and the attempts to vent the reactors happened. So this is kind of some big news as far as understanding the meltdowns, but it's also this big environmental and public health story.
Why does Simply Info consider microparticles the greatest ongoing risk to public health?
There's a number of reasons. One is this issue of microparticles and the fact that they can be, you know, inhaled or ingested into your system has never been part of the public health response to the disaster. the potential for someone to inhale microparticles and have that be a long-term ongoing exposure is not included in any of the research that's being done. There's research being done by the government of Japan on public health. There's research being done by international bodies like the WHO on, you know, the public impact to health from the Fukushima disaster. All of these aspects of trying to figure out how people were exposed doesn't look at microparticles. They're looking mainly at just a generic internal exposure or an external exposure. And this big factor is missing in all of the estimates of people being made sick, being exposed to radiation. So this is kind of the missing link in public health. As far as the environment goes, this is also a problem with the environment. The Japanese government went through many of the cities that were in the evacuation zone or places that were known to be higher in radiation, and they power washed buildings, they power washed pavement, they cleaned up leaves and dirt debris, and in some places they scraped the topsoil off, and they put all of this into storage bags, you know, to try to kind of protect the public, and they declare somewhere decontaminated. But what's missing is anywhere that's not been decontaminated can cause contamination to go back into that area. There have been many towns where they decontaminate a town, and a couple months later, the radiation levels start to rise. What's happening is dirt and water runoff from the forest or somewhere else, you know, upstream that hasn't been cleaned up, comes rolling back in because of the nature of things. Dust blows, things migrate in water, and these neighborhoods would end up recontaminated. So the fact that things are recontaminating and the fact that places like many of the forest areas are never cleaned up and can't be cleaned up, we know that these microparticles can still exist in the environment, and they are still being found today, so they're not all cleaned up and neatly gone away. So anytime that there's an event where the weather, you know, makes the wind blow up, people can inhale them. If people are working in dirty environments, if you're walking where you're kicking up dust with your feet as you're walking, these are situations where you can bring this into your lungs. So anyone that's in these regions that had fallout from the disaster that include microparticles, this is still kind of an ongoing hazard.
What, if anything, is the Japanese government doing to address this risk?
Nothing. They are doing nothing. This is not on the radar at all with any of the government response to the disaster, environmental, public health, or anything else. They have completely ignored this issue. The press in Japan and elsewhere has kind of not really paid attention to this either. But if you go looking in academic journals, in research, in the more dry reports from the groups that are actually tasked with cleaning up the disaster site, you know, at the plant at Fukushima, they all talk about this. So it's well known in academic circles. It's well known in the places most people aren't reading. So there's this big disconnect between what is known in one sphere and what the public understands. This is why this issue has become kind of our number one thing this year that we want people to understand, is that this risk still exists and it's just not being broadcast well enough.
Now, TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Company, and its executives, we read headlines that they have been found guilty. But what specifically have they been found guilty of? And from your perspective, what was the most critical aspect of the trial and the most damning information about TEPCO's actions that came out?
The trial has been going on for over a year. It took years for this to even come to trial. And Japanese courts work much slower than one would expect in a United States court, where something will go on for a couple of weeks and it's completely done. This trial has stretched on for a year. There have not been determinations yet. We're still waiting to hear back from the court with a determination if they're found guilty or not. The prosecutors are asking for 5-year prison terms for each of the three executives. So this is a pretty big deal. Even in Japan, where people can be found guilty of corporate negligence, long prison terms are not the norm. So prosecutors are taking this seriously. They really want to go after these guys. Some of the more interesting things found in the trial, they brought a number of TEPCO workers in to testify. And they told of a report that was given to them in 2007 from the government that said, we think earthquakes in this region could be far larger than any of our previous estimates that we've put out as a government agency. So we want you to look at this and see if there's anything you need to do to respond to it. The workers at TEPCO in their corporate office went through this and did a new analysis of the tsunami risk at Fukushima Daiichi, and they found that it was very probable that a 15.7-meter tsunami could hit the plant. And that is almost exactly the height of the tsunami that did hit the plant in 2011. So this prediction they came out with was very accurate, almost scary accurate. What happened next was really interesting, though. The workers brought this to the upper executives at TEPCO and said, we need to do something. The workers say they were given permission to start developing protection systems for the plant to try to mitigate the threat of a huge tsunami hitting the plant. And those workers began that work. At some point, they were told by one of the vice presidents to stop doing this work. And this is where the stories conflict. The executives come up with these circular arguments of, we didn't know about it, we never gave any permission, but there was no real threat, and this analysis was completely wrong. The same analysis they just said they'd never heard of. I wish I could have been at the trial, because listening to all of this, I think, would have been very interesting to watch as it took place. But basically, it came down to all of these workers that worked in the engineering division at TEPCO saying, you know, we knew this. This was our analysis. We thought this was a true risk. We started working on it. The executives squashed it because they were afraid it would cause some bad public relations if people knew there was this severe of a risk to the plant. The executives are all claiming, we knew nothing about this and there was no risk, even though this happened. What was in this prediction actually happened.
So they're on trial because they're accused of stopping the protections, or because they knew of the warning beforehand, or are there other aspects to this?
The crux of the criminal negligence trial is that they knew there was a risk, and instead of doing something about it, they purposely squashed any efforts to take a chance to protect the plant. So they both knew and took actions that made sure there was no effort to protect the plant. And what's interesting is, by contrast, there is another older plant on the same coast down in Tokai, which is closer to Tokyo. They were given a similar analysis by the government at the same time. This plant went ahead and they found similar with their analysis, and they went ahead and started making protections and already had them in place by 2011. TEPCO saying we couldn't do this, or we shouldn't, or we didn't have to, is kind of proven false by this other plant that did all those things.
And obviously it was a plant that was not operated by TEPCO.
Correct. It was operated by Japan's Atomic Energy Agency.
Let's move this along. What's being called decommissioning work is moving forward, and I need to hit the pause button on that, because that is a misnomer. Decommissioning is when you officially stop using something that has been in operation, or you remove something from service. These reactors and the area around it, they're already dead and gone, so they cannot be decommissioned. What's happening is the mitigation of a disaster site that had three nuclear meltdowns. So having straightened out the languaging, we come back from that sidebar. How is this disaster cleanup proceeding, and what does it tell us about what happened during the accident?
And you're very correct to call decommissioning a complete misnomer, and this is TEPCO's affection for nice-sounding terms. They do this quite often. They'll call something a very benign term that just really doesn't fully represent what they're talking about. And this is recovering from a disaster, or recovering as best as you can. The efforts that have been going on in the last year and since the disaster initially happened have been very slow in going. They've come up with some plans. They kind of have an idea how they're going to approach things like removing the fuel debris. But actually getting to that point is years down the road, and there's lots of research that's going to have to take place to make the technology that they need to actually be able to do this. So they may talk about, we're going to use this robotic arm, and we're going to go in and we're going to grab fuel debris, and we're going to put it in a container, and we're going to go store it somewhere safe. But getting from point A to point B is a very long road. As far as some of the more day-to-day work at the plant, there's been a little progress in the last year, but it's very slow. They're starting to go from the easy things they could kind of pick off the top, to do to kind of stabilize things on site, to the things that are harder. And so as years go on, I think we're going to see progress is going to happen, but it's going to be very slow.
Take us through the condition or the issues that are currently up at each of the three units at Fukushima Daiichi.
Probably the biggest thing they've come across in the last year at Unit 1 is something called skyshine. And what this is when there's radiation emitted from a source and it bounces out of the source and it will hit up in the sky and actually be deflected back down to Earth. And TEPCO discovered this is happening from the reactor well of Unit 1. Anyone who's familiar with what the damaged reactors look like knows that Unit 1 lost the refueling floor. You know, the whole top level of the reactor is missing. The refueling well, this is where they have these big concrete slabs, and when they're normally doing a refueling on the reactor, they remove these concrete slabs. There's two big heavy containment domes down in there made out of steel that they remove to get into the reactor to replace the fuel. With the refueling floor gone, this reactor well and the concrete slabs is what's facing the environment. And they're seeing skyshine coming up through this. And this is kind of significant because it says one of two things. It says either, one, there's lots of fuel debris and radioactive source material in that reactor well area where it can skyshine up, or there's so much radiation being emitted through cracks in all of this that it's causing the skyshine effect. So it's an interesting telltale sign about how damaged this reactor is. Skyshine doesn't make a problem for people far away from the reactor building itself, but it is a big risk for anybody that's working in that area.
What about the other two reactors? Is it a skyshine issue, or are the problems they face different?
Unit 2 and Unit 3, we haven't heard any reports that they have skyshine problems. Unit 3 is in a similar situation to Unit 1, where there's no refueling floor left because of the explosion it experienced. They do have very high radiation levels around that reactor well, and they have put in place multiple layers of shielding. They put lead and steel and some other things on top of that to try to kind of block the radiation level. And this has enabled them to then put a building on the spent fuel pool area and do more work on that reactor unit. Unit 2 still has the refueling floor building for now. The walls and the roof are still there, but there's so much radiation in the refueling floor area, they can only send robots in there. So they have not had any human entry to that area yet because of the high radiation levels.
It seems critically important to figure out how these meltdowns took place. What will that tell us, and how will it help with future nuclear situations, and hopefully not, but probably at some point, another nuclear disaster?
There's a number of different things that are starting to be kind of learned about the meltdown at Fukushima Daiichi in each of the units. And, you know, what does this tell people about the total understanding of how meltdowns happen and what can happen in one? There's limited historical experience with this. Nuclear researchers have done computer modeling and laboratory testing to try to kind of get a better grasp for how meltdowns happen and what they can do, but they still only know so much. So Fukushima Daiichi is giving us new information to understand how meltdowns can happen, how severe they can be, what kind of behaviors can happen that maybe nobody expected. And part of trying to understand this, they've done some more investigation inside Unit 2. They've gone in and looked, they did find what they consider to be fuel debris under the reactor vessel in containment. And they've gone in recently in the last couple of months and they poked it. It's kind of a simplistic way to explain what they did. They took a robotic arm, they put it into containment, and they kind of messed around with the fuel debris to see if it would move. You know, is it all stuck to itself? What happens when they try to touch it or move it with a robotic arm? And this sounds very simplistic, but it did give them quite a bit of information. At least in terms of Unit 2, they know that what's on the top level of it is loose and moves around quite easily. What's below that is solid. But one of the more interesting things that goes with this is the radiation levels where they were at, where they were actually touching this fuel debris, were quite low. They were in 7 to 8 sieverts per hour, which is, I mean, it's a deadly level of radiation, but it's not what you would expect. By contrast, there was an area further away in containment where they didn't expect to see any fuel debris that was 200 to 300 cyberts an hour, and that was enough to kill one of the robots on a previous mission a couple of years ago. So they found the fuel debris, but now it's not really radioactive. And that gives us a huge clue about what's going on with this. We know what they were finding on the top surface wasn't super radioactive. It wasn't as radioactive as it should have been. So that hints that there's not a lot of the actual uranium from the nuclear fuel in the substances they found. So that means it's somewhere else. Our best guesses are one of two things. One is that more of the fuel was ejected to the environment than we understand. The other option is that the nuclear fuel that contained most of the uranium fell into that area first and is buried down into the concrete of the building. And what came after that was mostly steel fell on top of it, and then that's shielding the radiation level. And why that's such an interesting situation, if that's the case, that super hot, full of uranium fuel that's melted and is down in the concrete now has all this what they call decay heat. It's generating its own heat as the fuel is slowly decaying its radiation. And this means it can burn deep down into the concrete. So this starts to become a situation where it can be anybody's guess how far that fuel burned down into the concrete below the reactor.
That would be China syndrome, except China's in a different direction. They'd have to find another country to make an equivalency on that.
We will return to the second portion of our special report with Nancy Faust on Simply Info's Fukushima Update 2019 in just a moment. But first, progress has been made. I've been able to book my flights into the 40th anniversary of the Three Mile Island nuclear reactor meltdown, which is coming up at the end of March. As activists and the media converge from around the world at the site of the world's first commercial nuclear reactor meltdown, I will be there to bear witness, interview people, and bring you the full story from those who lived through that horrifying experience and still live with its aftermath. There are so many stories from Three Mile Island that haven't been told and need to be told, and that's what I will be there to do. So, yes, I am going. But still, there are a host of other expenses besides the airfare that I need to come up with to cover this trip. Nothing elaborate, just meals, ground transportation, housing-related expenses, even, I'll confess it, dog care for Munchkin back home. It's the basics. So if you can help, please do it now. It's easy to donate. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button to make a one-time donation, or if you want to keep going with your support for the show, you can set up an automatic recurring donation of any size. And if you donate $100 or more to help support the trip, you'll receive a personally signed copy of my book, Yes, I Glow in the Dark, 1 mile from Three Mile Island to Fukushima and Nuclear Hot Seat. So please don't delay. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, give what you can, and know that whatever you can do, you've got my gratitude. Now we return to my conversation with Nancy Faust of Simply Info on that group's 2019 Fukushima Year 8 update.
There seem to be no limit on the number of scandals that are being generated in the wake of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster. Review for us first the Yamashita scandal, who he is, what he did and didn't do, and why his actions are so heinous.
Dr. Yamashita was an expert from the World Health Organization. He worked for a university, I believe down in Hiroshima, as a radiation health expert. He was brought in when the disaster initially happened by the government. He was who they went to for advice on what to do about trying to protect public health once they knew there were meltdowns going on at Fukushima Daiichi. Dr. Yamashita told the government there was no need to hand out potassium iodide to anyone. That includes the people that were evacuating, people that were nearby, anyone even downwind. He said there's no need, there's not going to be exposures that are high enough that are going to warrant this, so don't distribute it. So the government never told local governments to hand it out. There was no order to hand it out. And so most people did not get this.
And this was on his recommendation and nobody else's, correct?
Correct. He was telling the government his advice. He was considered the expert. He is a representative of the World Health Organization. The government took his word that he was the expert and he knew what he was doing. No one was second-guessing him. This was the information he was giving. Around the same time, he was telling the press the same thing. There's no need. Nobody's going to have a high exposure. We don't need to hand out potassium iodide. Everything's going to be fine. He was telling people at Fukushima Medical University the same thing. He was telling them, don't abandon your posts. And he said this quote when people were asking him at the university about preventing thyroid cancer. He said, it's nothing but iodine religion, which is kind of, it's kind of a strange phrase, and I think it maybe doesn't come all the way through in translation, but he was trying to tell people that you don't need potassium iodine and that there's not going to be a big exposure, so you don't have to worry about thyroid cancer. So he's telling this to the people at Fukushima Medical University, who are the people that are left responding to the disaster. This is the biggest hospital in the region. But what we found, at the same time he's telling the press and the public over and over and over, there's no risk, there's no risk, there's no risk. What was found a couple of months ago was a paper left in the off-site center in Fukushima. And what the off-site center was is they have it appointed that if there were to be a nuclear disaster, that there would be a site that was far enough away from the nuclear plant that government response workers could work there as a command center so that they would safely be able to coordinate evacuations, tell someone else that they need to have, you know, an evacuation of a hospital or they need a bus to come get people, you know, that they need this or that. This off-site center originally was 4 miles away from Fukushima Daiichi. It had been moved to Fukushima City. What was found in this off-site center in Fukushima City was a letter written by Dr. Yamashita telling the people that were working in this off-site center that there was a serious possibility of thyroid damage to children in the region. This letter was dated the day before he gave the speech to Fukushima Medical University. This letter was written all around the dates where he was telling the government, the press, the public, the health workers. He was telling all of them there was no risk. Right in the middle of this, he gave someone inside this memo saying, there's a risk. And this is a big deal because this guy, even after the fact, was saying that he was sure there was no risk and that the fact that the radiation levels were higher were a misunderstanding and a mistake. So this letter, everything he said during the disaster and after the disaster is proven a lie by this letter.
This is horrific. Has there been any kind of legal follow-up or certainly reputational follow-up on this to condemn the man and possibly bring him to task for what he did, which was, in essence, expose generations of the future to the radiation risk right now to the thyroids of all the children who were exposed?
This letter was found recently. It's been within the last about 60 days that a journalist found this letter when they were allowed to tour the off-site center. So it hasn't quite cascaded down that far yet. It made the press in Japan. I saw it in at least three different sources that had published about this letter. I haven't seen anything looking at taking legal action against him yet, but it honestly would not surprise me if that eventually happens. Dr. Yamashita had been in charge of this response during the disaster. After the initial disaster, he was put in charge of what is known as the health survey, and this is all of the efforts to track public health of those that were exposed. This is the effort where they go in and they were doing ultrasounds of children's thyroids, doing biopsies, actually going in and removing a children's thyroid if they need it. So all those official numbers you see about how many children have thyroid cancer in Japan, those are numbers that were coming out of the survey he had been working on. This health survey also looked at people, adults and children living in the area, and estimating what their exposures would be. He was in charge of this for at least about 2 years, and then some of his statements and his actions started to kind of catch up with him, and they decided he needed to not be in charge anymore, and they put someone else that was already working on this in charge of the health survey. So he's no longer formally involved with this anymore, but this person that did this has been in charge of everything, start to finish, for this long period of time. And this is the central piece of information that is claiming what the public health outcomes are going to be. So what he did has a huge impact.
And, of course, he was doing this in the first 2 years, which is when the damage and the impact is the greatest. And we will never know what data he obscured or never collected. There's so much more we could do on the subject of Dr. Yamashita, but there's another scandal. What is the Hayano study, and what does it show us about the ongoing deception of the public regarding Fukushima?
There were a pair of studies done by Dr. Hayano and a partner of his that involved the city of Date, and this is a small city in Fukushima Prefecture. The city decided they wanted to do what they called a glass badge study. And what this is where they gave every one of the citizens that were willing to participate, they got a little glass badge, which is a dosimeter, and that records their radiation over a period of time. And then they turn it in, the data is collected by the city, and the city made a database out of all of this. So this went on for, I believe, 3 years that the city collected all this data. Dr. Hayano wanted to do a study off of this data and made an agreement between the university he was working at and the city. And this had, of course, because it's a formal study that would be presented to a journal, it needs to go through an ethics review. So a researcher would take this outline of what they're going to do, submit it for an ethics review, that comes back, and then that becomes the guiding rules of what this study and the researchers have to abide by. What happened next is what goes completely off the rails. Dr. Hayano was given data by the city of Date, but it contained everyone's readings, those who agreed to participate in the study and those who did not agree to participate in the study. All of the people from Date were included in the study, including those who did not give their permission. This is an ethical violation that is still kind of up in the air in Japan, what's going to actually happen with it. But these people's personal information was given away and used in a study and published without their permission. So this was problem number one. Some other researchers in Japan started looking at these studies and noticed flaws in the study and things that didn't make sense. And they started going back through this, and what they discovered was that what was being hailed as being 3 years of radiation data was only 1 year worth of radiation data. So everything in this study was reality was now reduced to one-third of what it actually was.
And do we know which year it was, or was it random per person?
It was a three-year period. I believe it started in 2012 that the city did the glass badge project. Almost kind of a side issue with this is when it happened, but the fact that the study was widely publicized when it came out as proof that exposures in Japan were nowhere near as bad as any of the other data was saying. And one of the things they compared their data to was the U.S. Department of Energy had sent a plane over in 2011 and took radiation readings from this aircraft. This is a method where they can go and do wide swaths of land and map out radiation levels. And they did this through most of Japan over a period of a couple of months in 2011. So what the study was trying to claim was that the Department of Energy radiation readings for Japan were artificially high, and that people weren't really being exposed to that much radiation because they were using one-third of the actual exposure recorded. Now, there's also some problems with the data itself that the people living in Date City have said. Many of the people said, well, we got this glass badge, I hung it up by my door, and I never wore it. Other instances, kids would tie it to their backpack, so it only recorded the radiation levels wherever their backpack was instead of where they were. So when they're out playing on the playground, if they're out playing after school, it's not recording anything. It's recording what's in the classroom or in the bedroom. So the actual data itself was probably underestimating their doses to begin with, and then the study reduced it by a third. And these researchers that found the errors in the study brought it to the journal, and the journal asked the researchers that did the study, Hayano and his partner, these other researchers have found an error, and we think they're right that this is an error. What do you say? And they said, oh, well, we just got the numbers wrong out of the database, which seems like an extremely elementary error for a seasoned researcher to make off of a fairly straightforward database of numbers.
What, if anything, has been done or is being done to counteract or take action on these manipulated studies?
This pair of studies in particular, they're being challenged with the journal they were published in right now, but the journal has not been extremely responsive. They still have time to decide what they're going to do, so we're waiting to see if the journal is actually going to take proper action. At this point, the people that were challenging the studies were suggesting that they probably should be retracted, and I think they're correct in that this entire thing is so flawed, you know, the basis of it was flawed because they used incorrect data, and the fact that so much of the data they did not have permission to use, that the study should just be retracted. But this is a pattern we've seen over and over with some of the research done related to exposures with Fukushima. We've seen studies where critical parts of people's exposure are ignored, like they would look at an external exposure, ignoring internal exposures. We've seen studies where people were scanned with, it's called a whole body counter. It's a radiation scanner that will scan you kind of up and down your body and give you an estimate of how much radiation it's found in your body. There was a couple of studies that used those, but the time they were using to scan sounded like it may have been too fast, and there wasn't enough information for people to really fully understand, you know, were they taking proper steps, were they not taking proper steps. And all of these studies have found that radiation levels were lower than expected. So every time we're finding these studies that have kind of wonky methodology, they also happen to be studies that found a convenient result.
I think convenient result is a good way to phrase it, because long term, what this is doing is supporting the push to normalize the perceptions about Fukushima, whether anything has normalized or not in terms of radiation, and force the people who lived there to move back into the area and at the same time stage the Olympics there in 2020. There are several events. There are, I think, 8 total events so far that are scheduled to happen there, and normalize it so that people aren't concerned with being in Fukushima and spending their money and eating the food and drinking the water.
Right, and that's been, it's kind of been a distracted priority of the national government, is the response to Fukushima, instead of making sure farmers were taken care of and evacuees are taken care of and that they have meaningful help to do what they need to do to get their lives back together, instead of giving those people that help, they have focused on making the Olympics their priority and making optics their priority. That they want everything to look like it's fine, even if it isn't. And this is being done at the expense of a lot of people that live there.
There's so much more that can be said about the human side of this, but the report from Simply Info goes into a tremendous amount more technical information, and I want to get that as well. It seems for years now, we've been hearing that TEPCO is running out of space for cask storage of radioactive water at Fukushima. And TEPCO wants to and keeps threatening that they're going to dump it into the Pacific Ocean. What still remains in that water, and why is dumping it into the ocean not a particularly good idea?
TEPCO started with this narrative that the filtered water that's on site only contained tritium. Tritium is a radioactive isotope that's very difficult to remove because it binds into water and it's hard to break it back out of the water in a way that you can remove it. You can't just run it through a filter and have it be removed. So they were telling the public that, well, this water only contains tritium. You really should let us dump it in the ocean because we're running out of space. And this narrative had gone on for years. Well, now in the last couple of months, they admitted, well, actually this filtered water isn't completely filtered, and it contains this long list of other radioactive isotopes, and some of them are particularly long-lived and particularly problematic. So all this time they were begging for permission to dump this in the ocean. It was something that wasn't filtered completely and shouldn't be dumped in the ocean. So they do not have permission to dump this, and this new revelation will probably prevent them from getting that permission.
And the water still has to be stored, and now there's the need to store all of the spent fuel with the same problem of nowhere to store it. What is being done, or rather, what can be done about this situation?
the plant site itself only has so much land space. It was a fairly large plant when it was operating, and they had a number of areas of non-operational land that were part of it, and they've gradually used those up. They've used them for storage of radioactive waste of different types. You know, there's radioactive trees that they've stored. There's buildings they've put up that store pieces of building debris and random rubble. And there's other ones that store more radioactive stuff. There's also, every time they filter contaminated water, this makes a filter. And those filters are highly radioactive. Those have to be stored somewhere that's shielded, monitored, and is safe and sturdy enough that if something happens to this, it's not going to inject something into the environment. So that all starts to take up space. They've been building out spaces for these filters up on the hill, and that's taking up space. They also had built what they called cask storage, and this is like what you would see at a normal operational nuclear plant that starts storing fuel in casks out on the property. And they'll put like a concrete box, and it's got the fuel cask stored in that. They have some left, but it's going to fill up very soon. They also have a huge percentage of the fuel still to remove and no space for it. They not only don't have cask storage available for it, they don't have any land left to put more cask storage on. And something we found kind of buried in one of the recent reports mentioned that they're considering moving this off-site, but they don't say where. So we don't know if it's something as simple as they're going to look at buying land adjacent to the plant and build out there and store it there, or if they're looking at sending it who knows where in Japan. And I'm sure whoever lives wherever they're thinking of sending it will not want it.
Plus, there's the problem of transport and the kinds of problems of dispersal of the radioactivity if it's not done correctly, accidents, terrorism. There are so many things that can go wrong, as we know from the discussions of transport of radioactive waste that we've been having here in the United States.
Correct. Then this all starts becoming, instead of being a problem, it becomes an exponential problem. It starts involving all sorts of other things. So, yeah, if they start talking about moving things off-site, this starts becoming a very large conversation that needs to be had because it's going to start affecting a lot of people.
Going back to the way the accident began or what started it, when the first reports came out about the nuclear accident, several of them, the very earliest ones, cited workers saying that they ran away from broken steam pipes in the reactors after the earthquake, but before the tsunami. Yet TEPCO and the Japanese government and World Health Organization, the entire industry, seems bent on convincing us that the earthquake did absolutely no damage and that the problem was really one with the tsunami, which is a convenient difference to make in terms of the perception of the safety or lack thereof of nuclear reactors and dangers in places where people aren't anywhere near a tsunami zone. But recently, there's been a crack in the wall of denial. Tell us about what was found, where it appeared, and what it means.
We found buried in one of the recent reports, there's various agencies that are in charge of different aspects of the decommissioning work at Fukushima Daiichi. And in one of these annual reports, we found a passage that mentioned the cracks in containment and the torus room of the reactors from the earthquake.
They stated
very clearly. Yes, they state very clearly. And this isn't a report most of the public is reading. This is some of the very dry technical manual type stuff that we dig through on a daily basis. So the person who wrote this was talking to the other people that work in the industry, the other researchers, and he said very matter-of-factly that containment and the torus rooms, some of the reactors at Fukushima Daiichi, were damaged by the earthquake. And this is such a big deal because the U.S. nuclear industry and the industry in Japan have been adamant that there was no earthquake damage to the reactors. They don't want that to be a public question, because then it starts showing that any reactor that's in an earthquake zone could potentially be damaged by an earthquake. And one thing about Fukushima Daiichi that makes this even a bigger deal is the reactors at Fukushima Daiichi were built specifically knowing this was an earthquake zone. They were built to higher standards than you would have seen at a comparable reactor of the same design at the same year being built in the U.S. The ones at Fukushima Daiichi had extra thick concrete containment walls. They had extra metal rebar put into this concrete to make it handle an earthquake. All of the building systems were reinforced and supposed to be earthquake-proof. And so this earthquake-proof reactor couldn't handle an earthquake.
Plans for removing fuel debris from the reactors have progressed. When are they planning to start this part of the cleanup, and what is the danger to people and the environment?
The plans for all of this to actually start are at least after 2020, which is conveniently after the Olympics. It's convenient as, you know, this isn't going to interfere with the Olympics, but it's also, they really shouldn't be doing this while there's all these extra people in the country. They may or may not actually hit that goal of being able to remove fuel debris, you know, in 2021. It may take longer than that. When they do start doing it, there are a number of risks they've already identified. And there have been researchers outside of TEPCO's sphere that have raised concerns about this. And they're also being addressed in TEPCO's sphere. So we know that these concerns are legitimate concerns, and they are actually looking at them going, we need to make sure we don't have this happen. Some of those things are they don't want what they call alpha radiation, and this is things like plutonium and uranium. They don't want those particles escaping to the environment because those are a very high hazard to breathe. Those alpha particles may include the microparticles we've talked about before, but this is a big concern. They want to make sure that these materials inside the containment systems don't end up out in the environment. So they're going to have to come up with some ways to make sure things don't leak. The other thing they need to make sure doesn't happen is what's called a criticality. And if anyone is familiar with the Tokai criticality accident, there's lots of information about it online. It was an industrial accident Japan had back in the 90s. It released radiation to the neighborhood and the town near the plant. Two workers died. And this was just a small criticality that happened in a lab. Now, what could happen if a criticality happened to a large extent in one of the damaged reactors is it could cause damage or death to workers that are nearby. It could cause problems at the plant. It could cause radiation in the nearby neighborhoods and towns near the plant. And they're also very dangerous because making it stop requires some sort of intervention. And if people can't be nearby because this radiation that's emitting from the criticality is so high, then they can't get in to do something.
And when you say criticality, do you mean that it starts becoming a nuclear reaction again?
Yes. A criticality is when you have nuclear fission and it starts going not completely out of control, but it's actually making, when a reactor is actually doing its thing and it's generating electricity, it's a controlled criticality is what is going on inside the reactor. And what you don't want is that happening completely uncontrolled in a bunch of fuel debris that they're trying to remove.
I'd say that would be a good idea not to have that. I have got to ask, what in the world is or is not happening with that highly vaunted ice wall, which I call the slushy, which is intended to stop radioactive water from flowing from Fukushima Daiichi into the Pacific Ocean?
It's had mixed results. There was a couple of months early in 2018 where portions of it had stopped working, and they were trying to determine what was going on with certain ones. There was also parts of it that appeared to have been turned off for maintenance. But as they were turned off for maintenance, they thawed quickly. So this has raised a little bit of concern. What's going to happen if this thing is really challenged? You know, if they have an extended power outage or an equipment malfunction that they can't put back together in a period of days, you know, is this thing going to start melting and then what's going to happen? Also, they don't know what's going to happen if this were to meet a really big challenge, like let's say it's August and there's a heat wave and then they get hit by a typhoon. Then you have heat and you have lots of water inundating through here. And we don't know for sure because it's not happened yet. It's kind of one of those unknowns. Will it combat this and keep doing its thing, or is it going to start having melt-throughs where the ice starts thawing because it's just dealing with so much all at once? So this is one kind of concern, you know, that's still ongoing. They've closed all of it, so it is kind of keeping water levels down, but they're not 100% sure it's doing everything that it's advertised to do, because they are also removing lots of water from near the reactor building out of the ground. So they don't know, is the ice wall doing everything, or are some of these other actions helping it? Another thing that they found that's kind of an open question, there's some thought that deeper down in the layers below the frozen wall, that water is still being allowed to migrate through the groundwater, through the soil. So there may still be some path for water to make it out into the ground and potentially to bubble up into the sea.
Such an ongoing mess. This is an astonishingly comprehensive rundown that you have given us for this program. And it's clear that there's so much more information in the report from Simply Info. When is it going to be available, and how can people get their own copy of it?
The report will be available by March 10th. It'll be available on our website, and we'll also have it available on Amazon probably about the 12th. So the best place to find it is at simplyinfo.org. There will be a link to it off of our main page.
There will also be a link to it on the Nuclear Hot Seat page under this episode, number 401. Nancy Faust, you are always one of our most reliable sources when it comes to giving us the facts about what's happening at Fukushima and keeping us up to date on how this is progressing now that we are 8 years out from the start of that disaster. And certainly there's not going to be any end to our need for this report on an annual basis. For that, I thank the entire crew at Simply Info that work on this, and all of those people who are on the ground who report to you. And specifically, I want to thank you, Nancy Faust, for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Great. Thank you for having me.
That was Nancy Faust of simplyinfo.org. The report on Fukushima, their 2019 update, will be published on the site simplyinfo.org no later than March 10th. And will be available on Amazon as of approximately March 12th. Note that at this time, the report will be available only in English, but when that changes, we'll let you know. Believe it or not, there was actually more to this interview with Nancy, and we will include those sections in next week's Fukushima Anniversary Show number 2. For those of you who would like more detail about the problems with the so-called official medical statistics on the health impact of Fukushima, we will also have a link up to our very special interview with Dr. Alex Rosen of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. There's lots in that interview about how one should never trust the World Health Organization statistics on the health impact of a nuclear accident. This has been a special Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, February 26th, 2019. Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2019, Libby Halevy and Hardestry Communications, all rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevy of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, it's very nice to drink milk at an unsegregated lunch counter, but not when there's strontium 90 in it. There you go. That is your nuclear wake-up call. So do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.